I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is giving the first major speech on counterterrorism of his second term today. He's speaking at the National Defense University at Fort McNair in Washington. And in the speech, the president is laying out his vision for ending the war on terror, including the use of highly controversial unmanned drone strikes. We'll talk about the specifics of the president's speech in a few minutes. But first, about those drones. The Obama administration formally acknowledged for the first time that it has killed four Americans using drone strikes. In a letter sent to Congress yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder listed four names, three already known: Yemeni-American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, his son Abdulrahman, and a man named Samir Khan, who joined al-Qaeda's Yemeni branch. But Holder's letter also revealed a previously unknown fourth name, Jude Kenan Muhammad, who grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and was 23 when he was killed by a drone strike in South Waziristan, Pakistan, in 2011. For more on Jude Muhammad, we're joined now by Scott Shane, reporter for The New York Times. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first, can you explain, Jude Muhammad was on the FBI's most wanted list. He was also indicted in 2009 in connection with an alleged U.S.-based terror cell. Take through some of the allegations and how he first got on the U.S.'s counterterrorism radar.
Well, he's a young man who was born in the United States to a Pakistani father, American mother, grew up at least mostly in North Carolina. And as an older teenager, maybe around the age of 19, came under the influence of a Muslim convert named Daniel Patrick Boyd. And this man apparently infected him with the idea that he needed to participate in jihad, violent jihad at home or overseas.
And Boyd was convicted and imprisoned in 2009 for alleging he wanted to carry out violent jihad in the United States himself.
Exactly, yeah. Boyd and his two sons and this man, Jude Muhammad, and several other people were all accused in 2009 of being essentially part of a sort of would-be terrorist ring. And among other things, they had cased the Marine base at Quantico, Virginia, with the idea of perhaps mounting attacks to kill soldiers there.
Interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me ask you. So Jude Muhammad, you said that his mother was an American, his father Pakistani. They did spend some time in Pakistan. His mother had converted from Catholicism to Islam, according to your reporting. What were you able to get a sense of in terms of his young life before he met Daniel Patrick Boyd?
Well, people in the Raleigh area who I've talked to seem to think he was kind of a good kid, a normal kid. He was active in the mosque long before he was took on these radical ideas. And he was people remembered him volunteering in the mosque kitchen during communal meals, and even putting bagged meals on his bike and riding off to deliver them to elderly folks and folks who were homebound. So people had a high opinion of him and felt that he fell off the wagon at some point. He dropped out of high school. He allegedly began using drugs, was kind of adrift. And when this fellow, Daniel Boyd, took him in hand, he seemed to give him a new sense of purpose. Unfortunately, the purpose was to, sort of join the violent jihad. Mm. And when before they were all indicted in 2009, Jude Muhammad had headed off for Pakistan, partly allegedly at Boyd's direction, to go there, possibly to fight in Afghanistan, but just to have a kind of mission, a religious mission. Apparently, he thought that he needed to straighten his life out and get a purpose, and this was the path he chose.
And so then that was 2009. 2 years later, on November 16th, 2011, he's killed in a drone strike on a compound in South Waziristan, Pakistan. Do we know anything about what he might have done or accomplished in that two-year period before the drone strike?
Well, he was actually picked up by the Pakistani authorities at one point, and then was bailed out and disappeared. he seems to have been kind of hanging around the militant groups there. He was allegedly making some YouTube videos encouraging, you know, attacks on America, sort of generally participating in this jihadi world that he had joined. And he then fell in with a group of militants who were targeted in a so-called signature strike, which is when the CIA does not know the identity of the people they're targeting, but they judge from the fact they're carrying weapons or they're in an area controlled by extremists that they're legitimate targets. And apparently there were as many as a dozen people killed, and he was one of them. The people doing the targeting apparently did not know he was there, did not know he was an American, but he was one of the folks they killed deliberately on the theory that they were militants and enemies of the United States.
Right, and those signature strikes being one of the aspects of the administration's drone program that's come under most heavy criticism. Let me ask you, Scott, just a last question. Did the Obama administration have anything additional to say about Jude Mohammed or even Samir, I believe Samir Khan, the other young man from Raleigh who was also killed in that signature strike?
No, in fact, they said nothing, said a great deal about Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric who was deliberately targeted. But the three other Americans who've been killed in drone strikes, they simply listed their names. Mm. They gave no details at all.
Scott Shane is a reporter for The New York Times. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, as we mentioned, President Obama is giving the first major counterterrorism speech of his second term, and drone strikes have been a centerpiece of the administration's strategy thus far. The question is, will it stay that way? Julian Barnes is Pentagon reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Julian, can you first tell us about why you believe the Obama administration is shedding more light on the drone program in particular now?
Well, their policies have been evolving over the last couple of years, and they've wanted to put it on a firmer legal basis. They've not wanted to be the drone program to be something that history looks back on and says was a period of time when the U.S. was operating outside the law. They want to make the case that this is a controlled program, a limited program, and something that is overseen carefully by the government.
Mm. And as we heard Scott Shane just say, signature strikes are one of the things that the administration has used. What's going to happen to that particular use of drones when they're not 100% sure about who's, you know, at the sharp end of the strike, but they seem to think that it's worth doing it anyway?
Signature strikes have been one of the most controversial parts of the drone program, and for much of the Obama administration, not very well understood. It is these kind of strikes that really brought up the body count in Pakistan. Now, the CIA has at times pushed to extend the signature strike program from Pakistan to Yemen and other places. The administration has resisted that. And in recent months, in over the last 12 months, really, we've seen a decline in the number of signature strikes. And it may be something that is going to be formally coming to an end. And the Obama administration may not use this, or it's possible that this will be something used in very rare circumstances. These programs are classified. They're never entirely clear. But the era of the signature strike appears to be ending in any case.
Julian, I want to talk about the CIA's role in all of this in just a minute. But for clarity, I mean, the other major point of contention or controversy that the Obama administration has experienced with using their drone program is that places like Yemen and Pakistan, there's no overt declaration of war. Is the president going to speak to that use of drones?
Well, the position of the United States government has been that the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, what started the war in Afghanistan, allows the military to pursue members of al-Qaeda wherever they are, not just inside Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan, in Yemen, and in Somalia. Now, they certainly have not done as many strikes as in Yemen or Somalia as they've done in Pakistan. And in Pakistan, they certainly have used drones less than they've used them in Afghanistan. But this is unlikely to change. The U.S. government believes that this 2001 authorization by Congress gives them the power to pursue al-Qaeda, and they insist that they are careful about who they include in this under that umbrella of who really is an al-Qaeda member.
Mm. So, Julian, let's talk a moment about the CIA's involvement, or you know, some would say even lead, in the drone program. Remind us why that intelligence agency and the Pentagon are both involved with these drone strikes.
Yeah, so both the CIA and the Pentagon do have drone programs. The military operates in Yemen and also occasionally in Somalia. The CIA operates a little bit in Yemen, and their biggest program is in Pakistan. It's a matter of cooperation with the host country. The CIA has the latitude to operate covertly. They have the latitude to operate without the explicit permission of the host country. In Pakistan, we have a very murky relationship with the government on the issues of drone. There is an implicit permission to use drones, but they certainly don't give a thumbs up or thumbs down on individual cases. In Yemen, under the previous government, sometimes they were cooperative, sometimes they weren't. And so, therefore, when they were less cooperative, the CIA took the lead. But now we have a new government in Yemen that's much more cooperative on counterterrorism missions. And so, therefore, the need for the CIA is declining.
Hmm.
And there are people who argue that in Pakistan, we'd be better off if we had a more explicit partnership with Pakistan on the drone program.
And, Julian, we've got about a minute to go here. But there's also the question of, when it comes to counterterrorism as a whole, about Guantanamo and U.S. activities there. What's going to happen?
Well, we are entering an era where the administration is going to make a new push to close it, and they are going to begin by transferring some of these 86 detainees who are there and are cleared for transfer, cleared to leave Guantanamo, but they haven't been moved. Most of those 56 are from Yemen. There's been a self-imposed ban. The White House is going to lift that ban, and then in the months to come, we think the Pentagon will be signing waivers to begin the transfer out of Guantanamo to Yemen.
And does any of this, let me leave the president in a couple seconds we have, does he block him from criticism? Because I imagine that a lot of members across the aisle would still say, hey, look, this is the war on terror is continuing, and you know, something needs to be done, maybe leave drone strikes as the centerpiece.
Republicans are very clear that they think the United States needs a place that they can interrogate accused terrorists outside of the United States, and they think that place should be Guantanamo. The president disagrees. That's the fundamental fight over the future of Guantanamo.
Julian Barnes covers the Pentagon for the Wall Street Journal. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, an update on yesterday's brutal attack on a British soldier in London. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Officials in the UK are still trying to understand what provoked the brutal murder of a British soldier in London yesterday. And today, those same officials have identified the victim as Army drummer Lee Rigby. Two men using knives and a meat cleaver are suspected of hacking Rigby to death. He was an off-duty trooper in broad daylight yesterday near a military barracks in the Woolwich section of South London. The men then explained their actions to bystanders, one of whom recorded the message on his mobile phone.
We must fight them as they fight us, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I apologize that women had to witness this today, but in our land, our women have to see the same. You people will never be safe. Remove your governments. They don't care about you.
Police arrived shortly after the attack, shot the two men in the leg. They were then taken to a hospital. British Prime Minister David Cameron vowed that the country would not be cowed by the horrific violence and that it would reject, quote, the poisonous narrative of extremism on which this violence feeds. Joining us from London is Mehdi Hassan. He's the political director for the Huffington Post UK. And Mehdi, the scale of this attack is nowhere near, say, the 2005 bombings that took place in London. More than 50 people were killed there. And yet this attack was particularly horrific. So what's the mood in London today?
I think the mood is an interesting question because Londoners are quite resilient and robust, but there is a sense of shock and horror. Although the death toll is one dead compared to the 50-plus dead on the 7-7, the July 7th, 2005 bombings here in the capital, the difference this time round is the sheer barbarism and almost mindlessness of the crime. I mean, it's been described as Stone Age savagery by the former foreign minister here. The prime minister has called it kind of appalling and barbaric. And filmed by passers-by in southeast London yesterday, these two men hacking a dead soldier after running him over. I mean, it's just horrific.
And nevertheless, I read that the Metropolitan Police say that they've deployed an additional 1,200 officers around the streets of London. They're also monitoring social media in case anyone decides to use the situation to their advantage to further foment trouble. What do we know about the suspects who allegedly perpetrated this attack? I understand that at least one or both men were known to British security services at some time.
Well, that's what's emerged today, in that both suspects who are still alive and in hospital, one of them in very serious condition under armed guard in hospital, were known to security services. One of them has been named as 28-year-old Muslim convert Michael Adebolajo. The Intelligence and Security Committee of MPs is now being tasked to look into what did MI5, our domestic security service, know, and when did it know it, to remind ourselves of that question. Just to come back to your earlier point about going to high alert and having policemen on standby. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, gave what I would regard as a pitch-perfect statement outside number 10 Downing Street today, and I'm not always the biggest fan of our Prime Minister, and he said, you know, that one of the best ways to defeat terrorism is to go about our normal lives, and I think that's what's so important here. We've not seen a lockdown of London as we saw, for example, in Boston when you had your horrific bombings a few weeks ago. There is a worry about soldiers and the threat to soldiers, and there was a talk of banning soldiers from wearing uniforms out in public, but that was immediately rescinded, talk of that order. Once there was a bit of an outcry saying, well, hold on, if you do that, then definitely the terrorists have won. That's an overreaction.
And Mehdi, tell me, do we know anything more about the one suspect who's been supposedly identified, that 28-year-old Muslim convert, Michael Adebolajo? Because from what I'm reading, he's UK-born but of Nigerian origin. Any other details known about his background?
Unconfirmed reports that are emerging, as you say, a Briton of Nigerian descent, allegedly comes from a devout Christian family, took up Islam after leaving college in 2001. Various unnamed friends have said he was bright and witty, and you always get these pen portraits after the event, often after terrorist attacks. Of course, the suspects or the accused bombers or attackers are dead. In this case, the two alleged suspects are alive, and you know, we will probably discover more information when their health improves.
And what about the victim? I mean, he was allegedly a British soldier wearing a T-shirt in support of a charity for UK soldiers.
The soldier was wearing the T-shirt, as you mentioned. Flowers are being left at the local Woolwich barracks from where he left and from where he was followed. He's been praised as a fallen hero, and a lot of our condolences are going out to his family. It must be a horrible time for them to discover the death of their family member in such a horrific and brutal way.
The British media are reporting that there may be a heroine, if you can call her that, in this terrible event that happened yesterday in London. And that is a 48-year-old Cub Scout leader from Cornwall. Do I have that right?
Yes, and she was passing by on a bus, and she decided to try and first check whether this soldier was alive or dead and try and give him kind of first aid based on her Cub Scout training, but also remarkably kind of remonstrated with one of the alleged attackers, demanding he explain why he'd done it. And when he said, you know, when he allegedly said we want to cause a war in London, she said, you know, you will fail, you won't, we are many and you are few, which is a pretty bold thing to say to a man carrying a knife and blood on his hands. And the Prime Minister today has kind of name-checked her in his speech and said, you know, she is the best of British. She shows the real response of Londoners to crimes like this. And I think she has become very much a hero.
And Mehdi, I'm just curious because one of my big takeaways from this is that this potentially, again, allegedly, could be yet another act of homegrown terrorism in the UK. Is that where the focus is right now, once again, on trying to, you know, monitor or figure out, you know, what may precede events like this, such that, you know, we don't see these barbaric acts on the streets of London?
Well, very much so, and I think the government are treating it, I think, as a terrorist attack. The investigation is now continuing from the kind of rambling messages given to the passerbys and on camera yesterday from the alleged attackers. They do talk about, you know, there's that Islamist, classic Islamist narrative that we've come to know about, you know, Western troops in Muslim lands and revenge on soldiers who have killed our people, etc., etc. I mean, this is the great question, you know, what causes young men to turn towards terror and become radicalized? More than a decade after 9/11, we're still asking this question, why is it people turn to terror? No one really has an adequate answer.
Mehdi Hasan is the political director for the Huffington Post UK, speaking to us today from London. Mehdi, thank you.
Thank you.
The news is next, here and now. The weather's miserable today in Oklahoma. Thunder, lightning, heavy rain, high winds. It's a sad day, too. A 9-year-old girl is being laid to rest today, the first of the funerals for the 24 people who were killed on Monday when a tornado swept through Moore and Oklahoma City. Then there's the physical destruction to deal with. People who've lost everything, they need a hotel room and water, or maybe a general contractor to help fix a devastated house or a business. Well, Oklahoma's attorney general is on the lookout for scam artists and price gougers that come when disaster strikes. Scott Pruitt is Oklahoma's attorney general. And Mr. Pruitt, we read that you have investigators already looking into fraud in Oklahoma. What have you found?
What we learned from the 1999 tornado is that shortly after that event, there were what we call travelers who come into the state and prey upon citizens in a most vulnerable time, as you know, and re-victimize, if you will, and seek to take advantage of them in several ways. There are examples of charity fraud. There's Facebook and social media that's set up to make it look legitimate, and donations are taken, but not for the purpose of helping others. And then you have price gouging that occurs for basic items, storage units, hotels, car rentals, work gloves, bottled water. Exorbitant prices are charged as well. So the state responded in 99 with a price gouging statute that was very intensive.
This is the Emergency Price Stabilization Act
that the state
passed.
That's exactly right. And we are responsible in the Attorney General's office for enforcing that. So our 30 investigators on the ground are out there making sure that Oklahomans are not being taken advantage of and re-victimized. And we have seen some examples in the hotel area where folks have been charging exorbitant prices, and we've dealt with that. We've also heard allegations with respect to water. $40 for a case of water is what we're investigating. So these are very important things that we're doing to make sure that Oklahomans are not re-victimized after such a tragedy.
Now, the Emergency Price Stabilization Act mandates that there can't be more than a 10% increase on essential goods and services after a disaster. So when your investigators find that that's happening, that $40 for a case of water, what's the penalty? What do they do next?
It's more of an investigatory phase at this point, Magna. And then as we learn about situations, if it's not corrected, we take enforcement action, and it includes both civil and criminal penalties.
Yeah, and I can imagine that after the devastation of a massive tornado like that, like every aspect of life is touched. And so, you know, for folks who've lost their homes, for example, they want to get their lives back together. They want to get shelter and you know, rebuild. So what about, say, for contractors? What do you advise people in terms of looking for good contractors that won't take advantage of them?
The act that you referred to, the Price Stabilization Act, also extends 180 days beyond emergency for the very issue that you've raised, which is home repair contractors that come in and help rebuild. In this situation, Magna, having been on site, it's not going to be a matter of just putting a roof on. I mean, these homes are completely gone, down to the foundation. So you're talking about a major construction phase that will occur in the city of Moore and this area for many, many months to come. The education for citizens right now is not to put money into, you know, contracting with individuals to make sure that they have longevity in the marketplace, and that they were in existence prior to the tornado, that they're not simply a contractor from another state. We see that quite a bit. And as people deal with these contractors in the long term, we're trying to do all we can to educate them and to prevent the home repair fraud that we see in other instances. Mm.
Attorney General Pruitt, what would you advise folks who are listening around the country about who to donate to be sure that their money's going to the right place?
We're encouraged encouraging folks as best as possible to give to state relief efforts, charities that, that predated the tornado, that have a track record of dealing with these kinds of situations, not only in Oklahoma but across the country, but they're on the ground as we speak. I saw them yesterday. They were there ministering to folks with basic fundamental needs. That's the kind of relief effort that we need.
Well, Scott Pruitt is the Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma, speaking with us today from Tulsa. Scott Pruitt, thanks so much.
Magna, thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate your help.
Well, coming up next, forget about those styrofoam peanuts. How about packing your boxes with mushrooms? Back in 30 seconds, here and now. What if you could replace all the styrofoam, to-go containers or those big pieces that hold a new computer or styrofoam peanuts that you use in packing? What if you could replace all of that with something that biodegrades and doesn't use petroleum in the manufacturing process? Well, that's exactly what the founders of Ecovative Design are trying to do with mushrooms. Gavin McIntyre is co-founder and chief science officer for Ecovative, and he joins us from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. So, Gavin, what inspired this idea?
Simple walk in the woods, actually, by the company's other founder, Eben Baer. Eben grew up on a maple syrup farm, so spending time in the woods was not something unique. What he noticed was some fungal mycelium, which is tissue of a mushroom, growing on and binding wood chips together. And the real inspiration and the aha moment came from, how can we translate this natural process, this adhesion that occurs in nature, to an industrial setting and turn this natural tissue into a living glue?
What was the first step that you and Eben took to figure out if you could even grow things in a controlled manner?
This technology really got started while Eben and I were both undergraduates at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We just went online. We looked up some gourmet mushroom cultivation kits, and we brought them in-house, mixed them with some really low-density materials, and we fabricated our own tools so that we could grow these products into shapes. These first materials were mixed in our kitchens. We didn't have a clean room to start off in, and they were actually incubated under our beds and in our closets, because as you might be aware, mushrooms really like dark places.
All the greatest science is done in kitchens and at home in closets, I think. Was that first attempt or those first attempts successful?
Surprisingly, they were, but when we first launched the company and started to repeat our process over and over again in different spaces, that's where we ran into a lot of difficulty. We were very lucky and fortunate to have a great mycologist, Sue Van Hook, who's a mushroom biologist, join our team and really help educate us on the biological aspects of this process.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the biology in particular, because it's not the whole mushroom, it's not the whole fungus that you're using. You're using a very particular part of it called mycelium. Mycelium is a key building block in this thing that we know as a mushroom, right?
Exactly. Mycelium is truly the supporting structure of all fungi, from mold to mushroom species. The mushroom basically derives all of its energy, its nutrients, through this network known as mycelium. And then the mushroom itself is comprised of mycelium. What's interesting is the mycelium differentiates and forms mushrooms, or the vegetative roots type structure that grows on lawns and in trees, for example, just by the environment in which it's growing in. So based on the temperature, the CO2 levels, and even light, the mushroom will form, or it'll just generate more of that vegetative mycelium.
Mm. So that's what makes it so flexible. Essentially, it's a polymer. It's nature's original analogy to what we see in plastics all around us today. Is it going too far to say that?
That's true. In terms of its macroscopic level, what we can see with the naked eye, the mycelium really is that polymer construct. But if you look even closer at the molecular level, what you'll see is the mycelium, in terms of its cell wall, is comprised of chitin. This is the same biopolymer that you'll find in lobster and crab shells. So it's very robust, it's water insoluble, and it's highly cross-linked, which makes it very strong and great for industrial applications.
Hmm. So how exactly do you grow it? The mycelium needs some kind of substrate, right, or framework in which to grow. What materials do you use for that?
We go to local farms. We take things like corn stalk, or seed husks and seed hulls, byproducts of the agriculture industry. We mix them together with the tissue culture of fungal mycelium, and over the period of 3 to 5 days, the mycelium will grow, and start to bind these materials together. The beauty of this process is that there's no additional embodied energy. All the energy for growth comes directly from that agricultural waste. So it's really a set and forget process. We put it on the shelf and we come back to it 3 days later and we have a finished product.
Can you make it into any shape?
We have been able to make it in any shape, from very customized and complex geometries for protective packaging, replacing those end caps and things that you might get around a computer, to even large-scale panels for the construction industry. And today we're actually growing a house.
You're growing a house? An actual house?
We are indeed. So we've constructed some walls. We're growing some mycelium in between those walls. And we're even providing the house with acoustical tiles, since all of our materials are Class A firewalls. You can hit them with a blowtorch and they just won't burn.
So Gavin McIntyre, let's take a step back here. Now, I've read that you and Eben feel so confident in your new product that you think mycelium-based packing material could make your company the next Dow Chemical in terms of its size and impact on society. Do you really think that? Really?
Yeah, we truly believe that we have a revolutionary technology here, leveraging nature to replace synthetic plastics and foams. Every single aspect of where plastics and foams are used today, we've done some playing.
You know, I'm really impressed to hear that you can make this new mushroom-based styrofoam into any shape, even build a house, as you were saying, and that because it's all natural, it biodegrades, what, in less than a year, whereas styrofoam takes tens of thousands of years to change at all. Plus, there's the idea that styrofoam is a petroleum-based product. It comes from oil, which won't be around forever. But on the other hand, I heard you say it takes a couple days to grow these things. So do companies that manufacture packing products, for example, is that a timeline that's too long for them? I imagine they need all sorts of packing to be created, what, in a matter of hours, not days.
Yeah, that's a very valuable insight. And what we're really trading here is we're trading cost associated with energy and raw materials for time. And we've developed some really interesting processes where we can really reanimate our materials quickly and get them growing such that we can really meet the demands of real-time inventory.
So, Gavin, in talking to you, I hear the voice of the co-head of a young, ambitious company, and I respect your professionalism. But are there any times of the day when you're doing the work that you're doing where you step back and you think, wow, mushrooms? This is really cool. Like, this is just cool stuff.
Every day. There isn't a single day that goes by that there isn't someone on our team that is developing a new piece of technology, a new material, or a new market that I'm not awestruck by.
Well, Gavin McIntyre is chief scientist at Ecovative Design. They're using mycelium found in nature in mushrooms to create all manner of new packing and construction material. Gavin McIntyre, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
I have to say, I will never look at mushrooms the same way again. Well, before we go today, an African-American professor takes a critical look at the kinds of speeches Black high school graduates most often hear, and he says they're full of the wrong kinds of messages. You're listening to Here and Now. Last weekend, First Lady Michelle Obama had this advice for the class of 2013 at the Magnet High School in Nashville, Tennessee.
When something doesn't go your way, you just got to adjust. You've got to dig deep and work like crazy. And that's when you'll find out what you're really made of during those hard times. But you can only do that if you're willing to put yourself in a position where you might fail. And that's why so often failure is the key to success for so many great people.
Our next guest couldn't agree more. In fact, he's living proof. He was labeled a slow learner in fourth grade. That did not stop him. Now he's a tenured associate professor at Howard University. Ivory Toldson teaches in the counseling psychology program at Howard, and he too has some advice about what Black high school grads need to hear as they receive their diplomas in the coming weeks. Professor Toldston joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you've got a lot of suggestions on what Black high school graduates need to hear during their commencement exercises, as opposed to what they usually do hear. So
right.
What are some of the messages, first of all, that you say they usually receive?
A lot of times they get the tough love, scared straight, finger-waving type of message. A lot of times it's replete with negative statistics and oftentimes untrue statistics, like, you know, there's more black men in prison than in college, which isn't true, but it tends to make it into a lot of speeches. Some endorsement of things like the acting white theory, which also has no research validity to it.
Well, and if I may, the acting white theory meaning don't embrace black culture, don't be yourself? What do you mean by that?
The acting white theory is a notion that black kids purposefully don't do well in school because they attribute being smart to acting white.
I see. So essentially a lot of messages about negativity regarding the African-American experience, about their own lives, about don't do this, don't do that, otherwise you won't be successful in life.
Exactly.
Did you hear that kind of thing in your, you know, younger years as a student?
Oh, yes, all the time. And it's hard not to internalize a lot of those messages. And a lot of those messages make you believe that you have to disconnect yourself from your culture in order to succeed. And that becomes a struggle and a conflict for a lot of black children because they grow up in a certain environment, they love the people that they've been around, but they're constantly being bombarded with these messages that the people who may be close to you may actually be holding you back.
Mm. So tell me, specifically in your case, I mean, when you were just a child, you were labeled a slow learner, which is a label that, you know, ideally we wouldn't even hear in this day and age. And,
right.
You know, you're a professor at Howard now. So what made the difference for you?
Yeah, and, you know, my story isn't unique, believe it or not. Far too many young black males are assigned to special education, to slow learners classes, and overall, they have teachers who don't believe in their abilities. Now, in my case, lucky for me, I had a teacher the next year who reversed all that because she just really believed in my abilities. And so I can't say that I did it because of my own natural resilience. I would have to say that there was a teacher and there were other teachers who, despite my history, really believed that I was a capable and gifted person.
Yeah, and so I see what you're saying, that having figures in your life who believe in your abilities is important, but also continuing to hear that message through graduation and even in graduation speeches is important. So
yes.
If you were to be giving a high school graduation speech to young black students, what would you tell them?
Well, the first thing I would do is try to insert a bit of information that they may not have heard in their schools. A lot of the curriculum that black kids get doesn't really tell them about their true history, and it makes the contributions of black people to this nation a very passive contribution. You know, like the narrative of us being freed as a result of the Civil War is something that these kids get, when in fact there was an ongoing struggle among black people. And I mentioned the case of the black General Garson.
Actually, could you tell us more about him? Because I'll admit I had never heard of him either.
Right, yeah. And there's so many people who are saying that they've never heard of him, and they're going back and doing the research, and they're fascinated. But he was a black man back in about 1816. He inherited a fort that was left behind by British soldiers during the War of 1812. And so the British soldiers left. And he attracted about 400 black militiamen to take over that fort. And they attracted about 800 black people who fled from slavery in order to colonize around that fort and get protection from it. Mm. And eventually he raided a few plantations in Georgia to free other black people. And then when the word got out that there was this well-equipped fort in Spanish-occupied Florida, that was run by black people. There was a lot of complaints to the U.S. government, and General at the time, Andrew Jackson, led an effort to destroy the fort.
So General Garson and his story is one example that you give about the importance of shining a light on these active African-American participants in the country's history. You also talk about how these speeches need to create a personal narrative of success and really talk about how to be successful rather than what we were discussing earlier, which is the message of here's how to avoid being unsuccessful.
Right, yeah. A lot of times we use what's called a deficit model when we talk to young black kids. And the deficit model focuses on everything that may be against them. And one of the things I talk about in the article is when I asked a group of teachers and school administrators to describe the neighborhoods that their kids come from, I would hear a lot of things like single parents or broken homes, poverty, drug ridden, gang violence, different things like that. But then when I would ask, you know, has anyone in here grew up in a similar community? And then when a couple of people raise their hand, I would ask them, well, how did you end up here despite being in that kind of community? Then I get more of a measured conversation about some of the assets that you have in those communities. And in fact, a lot of people who come out of those communities, when they do succeed, they have more problem-solving abilities. They have stronger resilience. And so what I advise people to do is not to harp on the negativity, but help people to access the community's strengths and help people to understand that your personal narrative can come out of that community and actually make you a stronger person than you might be otherwise.
So, Professor Toldston, I have to ask, lots of readers have reacted passionately to your article in mm-hmm. The Root. You know, and some are saying that, hey, by writing this, aren't you really saying that black students, in the absence of these messages, they give up too soon?
Well, I think that black students really aren't given the types of messages that they need in order to pursue their dreams. They're given the messages that they need to conform to a standard that may not be their own. And by that, I mean, a lot of times we suggest to them that you need to leave your community, but a lot of times they want to help their community.
Right.
So the message that I'm promoting is a message to access their strengths and to make their learning more relevant to who they are.
Right. Ivory Toldston is in the Counseling Psychology Program at Howard University. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Negro Education and has written an article in The Root magazine called What Black High School Grads Need to Hear. Professor Toldston, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, we mentioned that First Lady Michelle Obama spoke at a high school in Nashville, Tennessee. Its full name is the Martin Luther King Jr. Magnet High School. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.